Hey everybody, this is Brian, and I've got some exciting news for you. Beginning with our next episode, our founder, former Home Depot CEO Frank Blake, will be taking over as host of Crazy Good Turns. In that show, he'll explain more about why and where this is all heading. For now, I just wanted to say thank you. Thank you for sharing your stories with us. In fact, one of the guests you're about to hear from today came to us from listener Ben Pitts in Nashville, who has been an avid CGT supporter for a long time. We appreciate you, Ben. And we hope that you like what you hear today. I also wanted to thank you for listening to our stories. We know that your time is valuable. It's the most valuable thing, really. And we're grateful that you spend a little bit of your precious time tuned in here. Finally, I wanted to thank Brad and Frank for offering me the opportunity to serve as interim host and express my gratitude to every guest who's been featured on the episodes I've hosted. This show has brought me the chance to meet so many incredible people, people who've inspired me to do more, or to look at the world a little bit differently, or just appreciate the amazing things that people do for others. Speaking of which, you're about to meet some more of those incredible people now.
I grew up in a small town in Arkansas, and I was raised by my dad. My parents had split when I was just a baby. As many people in small towns know, there's really not a lot of options and things to do and things to keep teenagers occupied and keep them interested in life. And so I found myself hanging around with a lot of people who were older than myself and started trying to be just as cool as them, which a lot of times isn't very cool at all.
Today's story starts with two guys who've made mistakes. They'll be the first to admit that.
I went to prison twice. My first trip to prison revolved around an armed robbery that I committed back in 1991. Me and my crime partner robbed a restaurant for a couple $1,000s and got away. My crime partner ended up going back to the same place and trying to rob it again about a week later and got caught and then ended up snitching on me for the first robbery.
Their names are Chris Comstock and Kenyatta Leal. Chris is the first guy you heard from. Kenyatta's voice came second. The two grew up far apart, Kenyatta in San Diego and Chris in a small town in Arkansas. But they have a lot in common. They didn't grow up with much, and at an early age, they fell in with the wrong crowds. By the time they reached their early 20s, each was behind bars.
So I started smoking weed and just skipping curfew and doing all those kind of young teenage things, which a lot of people grow out of in time. But with my personality, it was once I was in, I wanted to do it 100%. Probably about the age of 17, I had been in a good bit of trouble. I was totally hopelessly and helplessly addicted to meth. And that was my life. That was my everything about me. That was my identity, was a meth addict and a drug dealer. And that continued on through the next few years. I'd been in and out of jail. Eventually, the judges got tired of seeing me in their courts. They sent me to prison.
When I went into prison in 1991 for that robbery, the only thing that I was focused on was getting revenge on my crime partner who snitched on me. I wasn't concerned about changing my life or taking responsibility for the role that I played in getting myself there. The only thing that I was concerned with was getting revenge on him.
Eventually, within the walls of those prisons, something in each man changed.
I kind of threw a Hail Mary prayer in the Lord. You know, he caught the pass. And at that moment, next to my bunk, I just broke down and confessed all these things, everything that I could think of to the Lord, and just begged him to change me and to help me better myself and make myself a productive, useful person on this earth and not cause so much damage to my family and to anybody I come in contact with.
This one individual that I was talking to, he had took me through this exercise. We were on the exercise track, just walking some laps. He took me through this little exercise where he took out a pencil and a piece of paper and he asked me to write down the 10 most important things in my life. And I did that, and I gave him the paper back, and he looked at it, and he looked me square in the eye, and he says, "Youngster, you got 24 hours in a day. You work 8 hours, and you sleep 8 hours. How many of those remaining 8 hours do you devote to these things that you say are important to you on this piece of paper?" And what that exercise did was just revealed to me how I was talking the talk, but I really wasn't walking the walk. I was talking about what was important to me, but I wasn't living that way in my life every day. So from that point, I did probably one of the most important things that I did when I was in prison. I began to align my beliefs with my actions and slowly but surely began to retake control of my life again inside prison.
And so Kenyatta and Chris, separated by 1,500 miles, each set out to live a better life. They did so against the odds. More than 60% of prisoners who get released wind up back in prison. But today, Kenyatta and Chris are free men, happily working good jobs, and in Chris's case, providing for a wife and two young children. Both men are also helping other former convicts escape the cycle of criminal activity by working with organizations that had helped them do the same. In this show, you'll hear about The Last Mile and Cultivate, two second chance organizations that help prisoners turn their lives around and build a real future for themselves and their families. This is Crazy Good Turns. We tell inspiring stories about people who do amazing things for others. I'm your host, Brian Sabin. To understand why a second chance organization matters, here are some facts about America's prison system. According to the Brookings Institute, there are 2.25 million people behind bars in the U.S. 95% of them will get out eventually.
And the big question is, who do you want them to be? Do you want them to be good citizens and be taxpayers, or do you want them to go back to prison?
That's the voice of Chris Redlitz. Redlitz, and we'll call him Redlitz because we now have two Chrises in this story, was a venture capitalist based in Silicon Valley. And as recently as 9 years ago, he'd never set foot inside of a prison. But then, a friend who was mentoring at San Quentin asked for his help.
She said, "These guys are asking me questions I can't answer. I know that you're involved in business." And I don't think she even really understood fully what I was doing, but she said, "Would you just come and answer some questions?"
So on a dark October night, Redlitz pulled up to California's oldest prison.
It was built in 1852. It's a pretty ominous looking place. And you walk in through the gates and, you know, there is a sign as you're walking through the last gate saying, basically, there is no hostage rule, which means that if they take you prisoner inside as a hostage, you're pretty much on your own. There's an upper yard and a lower yard. The lower yard is very large. And at times, there could be 1,000 guys in the yard. So I'm walking down this windy road across the prison yard, and it was kind of misty at night, and went into this small classroom. And I started watching these guys come across the yard. It was almost like Field of Dreams as they're coming through the cornfields. And all these guys just kept coming and coming. I was pretty freaked out, to be honest with you. Here I am sitting in San Quentin, notorious prison. These guys are packing this room. And I look around and it's like, where is all the security? There just wasn't much.
Redlitz expected to give a short presentation, answer a couple of questions, and then get out. However, the men in that room quickly blew up that plan and defied his every expectation.
That really struck me. But as the guy settled in and I started talking, I really saw this look in their eye like I see in the people that we invest in. You know, in my venture firm, we invest in very early stage startup companies. And I started to see the same look where they're really interested and they started asking questions. And this, what was supposed to be a 30-minute talk turned into several hours. That was one of those sort of seminal moments where I thought, wow, this is amazing. And my head started spinning like, we could actually do something here. You know, just, who knows, help a few people and maybe help them get businesses started. I wasn't really sure, but I left that night, walked out of prison, got in my car, drove home, and my head was spinning, and I walk in the door, and I said to Beverly, my wife, I said, I think we can start a technology incubator inside San Quentin. And she looked at me like I was crazy, and she said, Chris, no effing way am I going into prison.
Redlitz's wife is Beverly Parenti. The two were running a company called Kick Labs at the time, which worked with young entrepreneurs to develop new businesses. She soon let go of her resistance to Redlitz's idea and began helping him at the prison. Their organization, The Last Mile, was born.
We approached the warden, told him what we wanted to do. They granted us permission to actually start an initial program. We started out with 7 guys, and we were just going to kind of make up the program as we went along. Beverly and I committed 2 nights a week to go into the prison and 2 to 3 hours each session. The warden probably thought, you know, we'd get tired and we'd go away after a while, but we just kept coming back and got more and more engaged. And it was important for us to get the trust of the men too. And, you know, that took some time, but we went in for, I think it was 40 weeks. And every week we'd go in and did this, and it really started to evolve.
One of the men in that first group was Kenyatta Leal. At the time, he'd been in prison for 16 years under a three strikes conviction. The three strikes law stated that anyone with three felonies was a habitual offender and therefore subject to a much longer sentence.
I had 25 life, but I never lost hope of me one day getting out of prison. I saw what giving up hope looked like. I saw guys that had given up hope that were in shoe programs and sitting in the hole and dealing with all kind of mental issues. And I just didn't want to live like that. I didn't want my life to end like that inside prison. And so I always clung to this light at the end of the tunnel and this idea that one day, might be 5 years, 10 years, 25 years down the line, but one day I'm going to have an opportunity to stand up and speak for myself and potentially be able to get out of here, whether it's through a court ruling or parole board hearing. The idea was for me to prepare myself for that moment.
The last mile became a key part of Kenyatta's preparation. The program has a demanding set of requirements that inmates must meet in order to participate.
They have to be good citizens. So we have a zero tolerance program. They can't have an infraction 2 years prior to applying. And then when they're in the program, if they have an infraction, they're terminated immediately. It's one strike.
Participants also have to be able to set aside any differences they might have had outside the classroom. Prisons are notoriously segregated places. Within the last mile's classrooms, however, members of rival gangs sit side by side and work together on projects.
Developers understand there's a lot of collaboration when you're developing products. So the guys inside have to work together very closely. And it was important for us to keep a very diverse group in there.
What the last mile became is essentially a two birds with one stone solution. Well, really, it's three. Problem number one is that taxpayers fork over $60,000 per year for every inmate behind bars. The state of California, where the last mile is based, spends $9 billion annually to keep its prisoners locked up. Problem two is the lousy job prospects that a typical prisoner has when they get released. Brookings data shows that most former convicts work jobs that pay an average of less than $20,000 per year. And then there's the fact that there's a shortage of technical skill within the U.S. today. Many predict that by the year 2020, there will be 1 million more software engineering jobs than there are qualified people to fill them. The last mile trains prisoners to work in those types of jobs. They get paid well within the program, earning $17 per hour, where most prison jobs pay less than a buck. And in many cases, the skills they gain are strong enough to place them into real IT careers.
I would go into class at night and I would say, you know, if you work really hard, you're going to get a job in Silicon Valley. And I think most of them rolled their eyes like, yeah, he's full of it, you know, to begin with.
Time has proven Redlett's correct. Since the last mile launched its computer coding curriculum, graduates of the program have a 0% recidivism rate. That means none have returned to prison. In fact, several have gone on to get out of prison and earn jobs in Silicon Valley IT firms. One of them is Kenyatta, who was released in 2013 when California updated its three strikes law to exclude nonviolent offenders.
My crime, my third strike, was neither violent nor serious. It was just simple possession of a firearm. That made me eligible for resentencing. The judge saw all that, and he realized that I wasn't the same person, the person that he sentenced 19 years before that. So he agreed to resentence me to 7 years. About a week after that, I walked out of San Quentin a free man.
When Kenyatta walked out of the gate, thanks to the last mile, he had contacts he could call to help him start his new life. Over the years, Redlett and his team have brought in several notable leaders in tech to speak with the prisoners at San Quentin. One of them was Facebook founder Mark Zuckerberg. Another was Duncan Logan, CEO of a company called Rocketspace.
When I was at San Quentin, I met a gentleman by the name of Duncan Logan. He's the founder and CEO of a company called Rocketspace. He and I kind of hit it off, and after our demo day, in May of 2012, I just hit him up after our demo day. I was like, man, if I got out of here tomorrow, would you give me a job? And he said, yes. That was in May. In November of 2012, Prop 36 passed, which made me eligible for resentencing. And then in July of 2013 is when I was actually released. When I got out, probably within like the first half hour that I was out of prison, I was with Chris and Beverly and we called Duncan. I started at Rocketspace about 10 days after I got out of prison. I ended up staying there for about 4.5 years. I started off as an intern. I was able to leverage that opportunity into a management position and then a sales position. About 2 months ago, month and a half ago, I put in my resignation at Rocket Space and I started with The Last Mile full time as a business development specialist. It feels really, really good to work full time with the program. Like I said, I've always wanted to help this organization move forward and to be able to provide and help create opportunities for other people who are getting out. This work really, really helps keep me grounded, helps keep me focused so that I never forget where I came from.
Kenyatta says that the most exciting thing for him is what lies ahead for The Last Mile. The organization recently turned an old building at San Quentin into a 20,000-square-foot technology center, one that will enable them to teach prisoners at other institutions nationwide.
We're looking at being at 500 prisons in 10 years. I'm really, really excited about that. It's a lofty goal, but I know it's one that we can definitely achieve. We're on a trajectory to do that. And so every single day I walk into the office with some pep in my step and really excited about the prospect of starting off in a mop closet at San Quentin and going to 500 prisons across the United States. Yeah, I'm definitely excited about that.
Now let's return to the other Chris in our story, Chris Comstock. When we left him, Comstock was on the inside of an Arkansas prison looking to change his ways. He wanted to be done with drugs, but as so many addicts discover, the drugs weren't ready to be done with him.
I knew that the Lord had saved my life from this, but addiction doesn't care about Jesus. Addiction just cares about wrapping your entire body and your entire mind up, keeping it clouded so you can't process things really that clear. What I needed was I needed to be physically removed from that life, because once you're in there, you're comfortable there. I was very comfortable in the darkness.
The light for Comstock came after a move up to Nashville. Two friends from his church had helped him move up there, where he did some volunteer work to help refugees. He also worked as a cook at a burrito shop, where he met the woman who became his wife. But he says he really discovered his purpose during a chance encounter with a friend of a friend in a coffee shop. That friend's name? Joey Lankford.
If farming was easy, more people would be doing it and less people would be getting out of it. It's a tough job, but it is rewarding when you get done working at the end of the day and you can look back in the greenhouse or look down a 50-foot row of tomatoes or whatever and realize, man, there's a lot of food coming off of this. And I might have sweated a whole lot, but, you know, a lot got done.
That's Joey. And 8 or 9 years ago, you would not have seen him inside of a hot, dusty greenhouse like he's describing. Up until 2010, Joey looked like somebody who had it all together, a beautiful family, a high-paying job in the medical field, and all of the comforts that go along with it. But Lankford said it felt unfulfilling, so he and his wife dropped everything, uprooted their family, and moved around the world to Cape Town, South Africa, where he worked for a mission called Living Hope.
We were struck by the geographic beauty of the place. I mean, you've been there, you know. It is, I tell people still, I've been a lot of places. Cape Town is still, to me, geographically the prettiest place on the planet. The other thing that struck me was it is the purest cross-section, I believe, between the richest and the poorest in the world living side by side.
In Cape Town, Lankford and the mission taught Africans how to farm the land. In some cases, the people Lankford worked alongside were recovering addicts or convicts looking for a better way. The mission trained up to 25 students at a time. After 4 years of this work feeding people and rehabilitating lives, Lankford felt a call to return to the U.S. after seeing a statistic that shocked him.
It said there's 48 million hungry Americans, and what they define that as is people that don't get the nutrition they need to fulfill daily functions that were required by their job or their school or whatever. So just out of curiosity, I typed in the total population of South Africa, and the number that came up was 53 million. I remember exactly where I was at and how shocked I was for it to set in that, man, there's as many hungry people in the country that I left than there is almost the total population of the country I've been serving for the last 5 years. I sit here in Williamson County, which is right in the heart of Tennessee, and it is, like Cape Town, probably one of the wealthiest towns in the United States. And I lived 3 miles down the road from an African-American community that I never drove through. I didn't even know they were hungry. I'd sit by the guys at school And then when I showed up home, I went to a food drive over in what is the Natchez sort of African-American community. It was 3 miles literally from my front door. And a guy that sat two down from me at my graduation came through the line to get food. And I looked at him and said, "Were you hungry in high school?" And he said, "Yeah, sometimes." And I said, "I didn't know it, bro." And the reality of our proximity and our ill regard for our neighbor is just, for me personally, I'm not speaking about anybody else. I'm just speaking, it set into me and it began to ignite a fire in my gut.
Lankford knew he wanted to fight hunger around his hometown, but he wasn't sure how. Then a mutual friend introduced him to Chris Comstock.
We met at a coffee shop. I poured out my heart to him. He did the same to me. And I said, "I want to do this. I didn't really have any real direction in my life. I couldn't tell you what I was going to be doing in the next 3 months." And so Joey said, "We're going to go take the greenhouses down that have been donated. You want to come help? I'd like to work alongside of you." I said, "Sure." So we pulled the greenhouses down and we tried to label them the best we can. And we stuck them in a barn for like 3 months and then reconstructed those things on what is now the Cultivate site at the Ellington Ag Center. And that was a real crazy time. I was totally unfamiliar with greenhouses.
Cultivate is what they call the venture. And for 6 months, Lankford and Comstock worked together alongside a rotating set of volunteers. Today, the program follows a similar model with the people they call cultivators. These cultivators are former addicts or people coming out of a correctional facility who work consistently with the program for 6 months at a time.
We get there at 8 a.m. They work 25, 27 hours a week with us. They get $10.50 an hour. We give 50% of our food away on the farm. So what they grow, they give 50% of that away. They learn everything from 8 agricultural modules to some faith and finance related things and then life skills, basic life skills. And then we move out onto the farm. Man, the farm is row assignments. It is picking. It is hot this time of year. I mean, yesterday they almost had to put a sign in memory of on the farm for me because I was in tomatoes all day. It is a hot, brutal kind of work day.
Difficult as the work was and is, Comstock felt drawn to it.
Just the ability to grow something and to see something grow and feed people, not only, you know, physically, but spiritually. It was something that I knew I wanted to be a part of for the rest of my life.
Comstock graduated from Cultivate's program and remains a farmer to this day. He's now the head of another farm called Living Well Farms that's about 20 minutes down the road. Every week, he returns to Cultivate to help other men learn how to tend the crops. The program works with 6 people at a time, but produces enough food for many more.
We keep the numbers low because we want to do a real rigorous life-on-life kind of discipleship model, meaning I want to be working with those guys every single day that they're out there. We will produce, we are 8.5 acres and 4 greenhouses now, and they told me that we'll produce about 80,000 pounds of food this year.
Half of that food gets sold to local restaurants. The other half gets donated and provided to food deserts in the surrounding area, communities that don't typically have access to fresh produce. No matter who's eating the fruits and veggies he grows, Comstock says that the feeling he gets when he sees someone eating his food is profound.
How do you feel when someone eats food that you've grown and loves it?
I don't really even know how I could put that into words. It makes you feel successful. It makes you feel like productive, which is something that's important to me because I've produced a lot of things in the past that were just bad and dark and very damaging to your soul and your body. And so to work hard and to grow something and to labor at something that when somebody eats it, you know, puts it into their body, they have a smile on their face and they light up. I think that's what keeps any farmer, small local farmer who gets to see where their food goes and gets to know the people that eat it. I think that's what keeps them all going, is just knowing that something they've worked so hard towards really does impact somebody's life.
Thanks for listening to this episode of our podcast. Go to crazygoodturns.org to learn more about The Last Mile and Cultivate. We'll also have links where you can donate. You can submit your ideas for people or organizations we should feature on an upcoming episode by emailing us at hello@crazygoodturns.org. Stay connected with us between shows by following us on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram at /crazygoodturns. Our show is audio engineered by Stephen Key. Music supervision and mixing by Score in Los Angeles. A special thanks to Megan Hamlin, and I'm your host, Brian Sabin.
I think we're going to see some real social change and see the guys that Chris is talking about, you know, that he met in prison that are genuinely some of the best people that he had ever come across. I echo that. I tell people I've sat in church my entire life, and the best dudes that I've met have been addicts that are just trying to put one foot in front of the other out at the farm. Yeah, it's time we, I think, bring that conversation into focus and really realize that we've both, regardless of past, everybody has something to offer us for our future.